Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Newsmakers from America and around the world speak with journalists in an unscripted and unrehearsed discussion about the critical issues facing the United States and the world. Here is your host on this edition of Press Conference USA, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is VOA Middle East editor and former Cairo bureau chief, Elizabeth Arrett. Our guest on this edition of the program is Shadi Hamid, author of the recently published book, Temptations of Power, Islamists and Illiberal Democracy in a New Middle East. Shadi Hamid is also a fellow in the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. He previously served as director of research at the Brookings Doha Center. That's an overseas center of the Brookings Institution based in Qatar. Temptations of Power, which is Hamid's first book, draws on hundreds of interviews with leaders and activists from across the region to advance a new understanding of how Islamist movements change over time. He began his research on Islamist movements before the start of the Arab Spring. In his book, Hamid challenges conventional and academic wisdom by arguing that it has been repression, not democratization, that has caused Islamist groups to moderate over time. When repressed, these Islamist groups tend to work in more coalitions, de-emphasize Islamic law, and set aside the dream of an Islamic state. Democratization, on the other hand, has actually brought out their more conservative tendencies. With the uprisings of 2011, Islamists found themselves in an enviable position, but one for which, Hamid argues, they were unprepared. Groups like the Muslim Brotherhood combine the features of both political parties and religious movements, leading to an inherent tension that they have struggled to resolve. Shadi Hamid joins us here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington to discuss his book and his research working with Islamists across the Middle East and to share his thoughts about the future of the region. Shadi Hamid, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And Elizabeth, it's a great pleasure to have you on the show as well.
Good to be here.
Well, Shadi Hamid, as I said in the introduction, you began your research on Islamist movements before the start of the so-called Arab Spring. How did your project change after the uprisings in 2011?
So I started conducting research on the Muslim Brotherhood in Jordan in 2004-2005, and that was an entirely different time. So it's been very interesting for me to track the evolution of these groups as they respond to various crises. And of course, the shock of the Arab Spring, the coup in Egypt, Islamists have gone through a lot, and they've really struggled, I think, to adapt and fashion coherent responses to changes in the region. I called my book Temptations of Power because before the Arab Spring, you see them very careful and cautious and even ambivalent about power, that they understood that governance was a dangerous thing. They weren't prepared for it. They had spent nearly 80 years in opposition in Egypt from the founding of the Brotherhood in 1928. And so they knew power was dangerous, but they succumbed to the temptations of power. So I try to understand how exactly that happened. And also this kind of counterintuitive idea that democratization may actually push Islamist groups further to the right for a variety of reasons. And I think this is challenging for Americans and Westerners to accept because we assume that all good things go together. More democracy, more liberalism, more education, everything is wonderful, so on and so forth. But this doesn't mean that democracy is bad. It just means we have to be realistic about what to expect. And I think the challenging question, too, is in deeply conservative societies, anyone who's democratically elected, Islamist or otherwise, is going to have to reflect that conservative religiosity to one degree or another. That's actually what democracy should do. So do Egyptians, Jordanians, or anyone else have the right to decide through the democratic process that they would rather not be liberal? That's not an easy question to answer, especially if you're coming from a Western context where it just assumed that liberalism is the only way to go. I mean, that's an open question. I mean, what I would argue is that if we want democracy, if we hope for democracy to flourish in the Middle East, it's going to be at least somewhat illiberal.
At least for a short period, or at least in the short run.
Exactly. And I think that that's preferable to the alternative of repressing Islamists. What we see now in Egypt, for example, a very brutal crackdown. So it might not seem ideal to us, but we have to accept that other cultures and societies, for a variety of historical and religious reasons, may actually want Islamic law to play a more prominent role in public life. You may have elected parties that want to restrict alcohol consumption. They may want to reform the educational curricula and Islamize it to have an effect on the next generation of Egyptians or Jordanians. These are things that we, as Americans, and speaking as an American myself, might be uncomfortable with, but I think there has to be at least a willingness to understand it, even if we don't like it.
And I think it's important, too, that we shouldn't narrowly define democracy as elections alone, and that's what I think we tend to do, perhaps vis-a-vis the Middle East. There are so many other factors or elements of democracy, rule of law, civil society, the opportunity for education. Isn't that right, Elizabeth? I mean, so it's unfortunate that when we talk about democracy, we think elections, but elections alone do not a democracy make.
Right. And again, in the West, we do assume a liberal democracy. And
exactly.
This idea of shadis of an illiberal democracy, I think, is very, very difficult and has not been grasped particularly well. One thing I'm curious about is how is it in Egypt when, as you said, a very conservative society that wants a reflection of these conservative things have turned against Islamists the way they have so easily with Sisi coming to power there?
Well, I think we have to be careful about assuming that they turned against the Brotherhood for specifically religious reasons, that they were uncomfortable with the Brotherhood's religious conservatism. That was certainly the case with what we might call Egypt's secular elite. And they drive the media conversation, are very influential in setting the tone for public debates. That is a big part of it. But when we're looking at the millions of people who took to the streets on June 30th, there's a variety of different reasons. And I think for ordinary middle or lower middle class or poor Egyptians, a big part of it was the economic situation was disastrous and the sense that the government wasn't getting things done. And if you actually look at Temarud, the movement which supported the protests of June 30th, which led eventually to the Egyptian coup, there was nothing in their demands which focused on the Brotherhood's religiosity. And we forget that, I think. But at the time, that wasn't actually their focus. Now, they questioned the Brotherhood's loyalty to Egypt, and there was this idea that the Brotherhood was somewhat foreign and weren't loyal to the state. So there are a lot of things going on there. But we also shouldn't assume that what we have now with the Sisi regime is secular. Sisi is not secular. If anything, I would argue he's more aggressively instrumentalized religion for political ends, more so than even the Brotherhood. He's used Al-Azhar, the premier seat of Sunni Islamic learning in Egypt and the broader Middle East, and he's used Al-Azhar clerics to shore up his legitimacy. In his campaign, he argued that it was the president's role to promote the correct understanding of Islam, to promote public morality. And Sisi supporters don't seem to have a big problem with that. And actually, if we look at Sisi before the coup, one of the reasons the Brotherhood was comfortable with him, and they were deceived in that respect, obviously, but one of the reasons they thought that Sisi was an ally was because he seemed to be quite devout. He seemed to support a bigger role for Islam in public life.
Well, Shadi Hamid, that leads me to ask you, perhaps we should define what we mean by Islamist party. Because there's such a spectrum. You know, we have the Muslim Brotherhood, well known in Egypt, and of course it has its counterparts in other countries. But then there's the so-called Islamic State, which we also call ISIL. And then there's, of course, the AK Party, the party in Turkey. Talk about the spectrum of Islamists.
So this is a great question, and I've actually been a little bit uncomfortable with the evolving debate in Washington and elsewhere. And a lot of people are trying to lump all Islamists together in the same basket that ISIS, Muslim Brotherhood, Hamas, Iran, they're all part of the same problem. And I think we have to be very careful and make fine distinctions between these groups. And it's worth noting that ISIS very harshly criticizes the Brotherhood. And not just that, they've actually accused the Brotherhood of being disbelievers. I mean, in the ISIS spokesman Adnani's August 2013 statement, about a month after the Egyptian coup, he actually associates the Brotherhood with, quote unquote, the religions of unbelief. That's a huge difference. And then you have groups like Ennahda,
right,
in Tunisia, the main Islamist party there, which are very forcefully arguing against ISIS's model. Now, they're all vaguely Islamist in the sense that they believe Islamic law should play a prominent role in public life. But within that, you have so much diversity in how you interpret Islamic law and how harsh you want to go with that. And obviously, ISIS takes it beyond the extreme.
It's actually a distortion, it seems to me.
Oh, certainly, yes. They're so extreme that even Al-Qaeda thinks they've gone too far. That tells you a lot right there.
One of the things you talk about in your book is the politics of stages. And you've seen certainly the Brotherhood as being the most patient, long-view approach to politics. And then you have the Islamic State, which seems to have completely dumped that model and just gone for straight implementation, and this is it. How does anybody who's trying to counter it or discuss, can you have a discussion with someone who's not even trying to convince anybody?
Yeah, so this is actually what ISIS has been arguing, that the slow, prodding, gradualist approach of the Muslim Brotherhood has failed. That the Brotherhood tells its followers the Islamic State will come in 20 years, 30 years, 80 years, and it never really comes. ISIS has been saying, don't wait, don't do it through the political process. The only way to have an Islamic State is to impose it through brute force and to actually just actualize it. And that's what they've been able to do. They've captured large swaths of territory, an unprecedented amount of territory for an extremist group. So they're able to say that they've been successful where groups like the Muslim Brotherhood haven't. And I worry that this is a bigger trend in the Middle East, that violence works. Maybe not in the medium to long term, but I think with ISIS, they can point to actual successes, in part because of their successful use of violence and their instrumentalization of brutality. They're not just using brutality for the sake of it, although that might be part of it. They're using brutality to instill terror in their opponents and to force their opponents to stand down.
So what do you think the Muslim Brotherhood and the more mainstream groups will take from this? And if I can combine it with the other point that you've made, that repression tends to moderate the Islamist groups. We're now seeing a bigger degree of repression, maybe even more so than under previous times in Egypt. What will all of these various external factors do you think have on the Brotherhood as it tries to regroup?
So one thing I'd want to clarify, because sometimes people get the wrong idea, that I'm saying that somehow repression is a positive thing because it leads to moderation. First of all, from a moral standpoint, I don't think we should accept that. But I argue in my book that specific kinds of repression have had a moderating effect on the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt and Jordan specifically. But extreme levels of repression, my argument doesn't really apply there. Because what we're seeing now in Egypt under the Sisi regime is not something we saw under Mubarak. It's not something that we saw under King Hussein or King Abdullah in Jordan. So extreme levels of repression are actually bound to have a radicalizing effect, at least with the minority of Islamists. So there's nuance in my argument, and it's not as simple as saying that wherever you have repression, it leads to X or Y or Z. And this is where I'm very concerned with Egypt. It's not so much that supporters of the Brotherhood are embracing Al-Qaeda-style violence. We certainly do not see that. What we are seeing with the growing minority of Brotherhood supporters is an openness to what I would call low-level anarchic violence, of attacking security personnel, burning police cars, lobbing Molotov cocktails. But beyond that, and perhaps what's even more troubling, is a larger number of Brotherhood members and supporters are losing faith in the Egyptian state, in the possibility that the Egyptian state can be reformed. So before Mubarak fell, they were very critical of government policies, but there was a certain degree of deference to state institutions, the military, the judiciary, Al-Azhar. They were critical, but they weren't calling for the end of these institutions. But because these institutions have become party to a civil conflict that has killed hundreds of Egyptians, and these institutions have become thoroughly politicized and appropriated by President Sisi, I think that Brotherhood supporters are saying the Egyptian state can be reformed. It has to be undermined, if not defeated altogether. So there's more of a revolutionary rhetoric, a more revolutionary approach to politics. And some people might say that's good if you are, in fact, a revolutionary. But revolution is also destabilizing. And that's, I think, one of the lessons of the past couple years. So that's concerning to me, because the Brotherhood historically hasn't done revolution. They've always told their followers, we got to go slow. We got to work within existing institutions. But especially with young brother supporters, maybe not even Brotherhood supporters, Salafis, Islamists, ordinary Egyptians who might be sympathetic to the Brotherhood but are just generally angry, they are increasingly in a kind of confrontational situation with the state.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Shadi Hamid. He's author of Temptations of Power, Islamists and Illiberal Democracy in a New Middle East. He's also a fellow with the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. That's a Washington-based think tank. I'm Carol Castiel, and joining me on the program is VOA Middle East editor and former Cairo bureau chief, Elizabeth Arrett. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA, and we want to hear from you. Connect with us on Facebook via Carol Castiel VOA or send us an email to PCUSA@voanews.com. Here's a shout out to a loyal listener, Alfred Likoze Kiwanuka from Uganda. Thanks for your feedback, Alfred. Well, back to you, Shadi Hamid, our valued guest. I wanted to ask you about an article you wrote in The Atlantic, The Roots of the Islamic State's Appeal. Of course, the Islamic State, also known as ISIS or ISIL. You know, we talked about extremism among Islamists. It's a symptom of repression in many ways. And of course, you said that to some extent, democratization has affected these movements in a more conservative manner. But I'd like to look at the appeal of the so-called Islamic State. It seems to me that their rise is a symptom of repression, or one might say marginalization of Sunnis, particularly in Iraq. What are your thoughts with regard to their appeal and how they become such a force, particularly in Iraq and Syria?
So ISIS was going to exist regardless, but their rise to this level of prominence was not inevitable. There are a series of factors that contributed to that. I think part of it is the international community's unwillingness to intervene in Syria. And Syria experts were warning the Obama administration from 2012 that if we don't do more to support the mainstream rebels and counter the Assad regime, there's going to be a power vacuum and extremists are going to benefit from that. And that's precisely what happened. So I think the lack of security, the failure of governance, the failure of statehood. I mean, there is no state effectively in much of Syria and Iraq. So ISIS draws on that. And this is where I'm also uncomfortable. If you go up to the other side of the spectrum and say that it's only about politics, it's only about failures of governance, and Islam has nothing to do with that. And this is what you hear from many Muslims who understandably are angry at ISIS for distorting their religion in their name. So I get where that comes from, but I don't think we can fully understand ISIS without understanding its Islamic inspiration. The people who fight for ISIS believe that what they're doing is serving God's cause. So I think at some level, we have to appreciate those motivations. And that also plays a big role on the battlefield, that when you're willing to fight and die for a cause, not just accepting death, but even welcoming death, that gives you an advantage over others who are fighting and don't really have much morale. They don't have a cause and they dissipate at the first sign of resistance. That's what we saw with the Iraqi army in Mosul in June. There were 30,000 plus Iraqi army and security forces, only about 900 or so ISIS fighters. That very small number of ideologically committed militants were able to overwhelm the Iraqi army. That shows you the power of ideas and ideology as a motivating force.
ISIL, Islamic State, talks about creating a caliphate. But there's some kind of a discrepancy, because caliphate in the history of Islam does not have the very negative, brutal connotation that the Islamic State seems to be attributing to caliphate, with their beheadings, a very intolerant, some sort of ideology that seems to guide them. Because when I think of caliphate, I think of Al-Andalus, you know, southern Spain, when Arabs were in control, they were overseeing large populations of Jews and Christians, and there was a great deal of tolerance. There was even activities going on which would be perhaps anathema to very conservative Islamists today. What about the caliphate, the Ottoman Empire, which was known for its tolerance? They took in Jews after the Inquisition, when Jews were expelled, when Muslims were expelled. They were tolerant of many minorities. I mean, this is not the caliphate that Islamic State is touting today. How do you account for that discrepancy?
This is a really good point. I mean, they're hearkening back to the old Islamic caliphates, which were actually known for intellectual pluralism, for accepting different approaches to religion, for accepting minorities. The list goes on, and also embracing science, technology, right, philosophy, medicine. That was part of the so-called golden age of the various Islamic empires, and in particular the Abbasid caliphate. So this is where there's a real dissonance. They're hearkening back to that memory, but obviously in the way that they act themselves, they're going against the very essence of that history. So that's certainly the case, and that rightfully angers many Muslims who look at their past with pride. But at the same time, ISIS has been smart from a marketing standpoint to appropriate the term caliphate for their own particular and unfortunate political ends, because they know that the word caliphate does have this broad resonance among Muslim majority populations. And if you look at other extremist groups, like Al-Qaeda, for example, they wouldn't even go there. They talked about the caliphate as an inspiration, as an aspiration, but they didn't actually try to establish it on the ground. And this is where ISIS is revolutionary, because they said, forget about all the theoretical talk. We're actually going to announce a caliphate on actual lived territory.
A caliphate which has nothing at all in common or does not, you know, reflect anything,
right,
of the true caliphates in Muslim history.
Right, exactly. But the overwhelming majority of Muslims disagree with ISIS's interpretation of the caliphate, but not necessarily the idea broadly of a caliphate. I mean, there is kind of nostalgia for it because it's associated with the success and economic and military power of the Islamic Empire. But what ISIS has done, it's re-injected the word caliphate into the popular discourse. So ISIS has forced a reckoning with ideas that had been submerged for the last few decades.
Let me turn now to Elizabeth.
The actual implementation of a caliphate is certainly very different from past examples, but some of the ideas, the sort of Wahhabi, Salafist, fundamentalist ideas that are being espoused by the Islamic State are not tremendously different than political systems we see in Saudi Arabia and the Salafis, although they have less of a political agenda in Egypt. What makes the Islamic State so different on that front in the war of ideas?
You're right to point out that ISIS draws on Salafi ideas that we see in other places. They take it one step or maybe several steps further to the extreme, but they're not making this up. I mean, they do draw from Wahhabi ideology, which is the dominant ideological approach in Saudi Arabia, for example, as you note. The vast majority of Salafi scholars have actually harshly criticized ISIS's approach, and even scholars associated with Al-Qaeda's extreme approach have also condemned ISIS. So it's not as if they've gained a lot of support from even extremist clerics. And I think there's a number of reasons for that. I mean, number one, Al-Qaeda and people associated with Al-Qaeda are uncomfortable with the revolutionary aspects of ISIS, and that they've also usurped Al-Qaeda's role as the premier extremist organization. So some of it is a kind of competition within the world of Salafi jihadism. ISIS doesn't seem to have any care for how bad they look on
perhaps
any number.
Even like being bad.
You know, yeah, there's almost a sense that ISIS wants to be brutal. They want to be bad. They want to be savage. As I said earlier, I mean, some of that is politically useful for them because it terrifies their opponents. So when the Iraqi army thinks to itself, well, what do we know about ISIS? They massacre hundreds of people in a given tribe. That's going to make them less likely to fight ISIS in a head-to-head battle. But another part of it, too, is the rank and file of ISIS, the fighters, many of whom are coming from Europe and oftentimes seem to have personal issues where they've been marginalized in European societies and they're searching for their own version of purity. And for them, that leads to this kind of extremist purity where there's no compromise and there seems to be a bloodlust that goes along with that. So how do you keep these very extreme foreign fighters in the tent? You have to give them the red meat, and that also explains part of the brutality of ISIS.
Well, as we conclude, Shadi Hamid, based on your research before, during, and after the so-called Arab Spring, do you see any models for Islamist groups taking power, reconciling democracy with Islamism? And I'm thinking of Tunisia with Rashid Ghannouchi, even though the Ennahda movement, of course, is not in power per se. They're sharing power. What about Tunisia? What about the future of Islamists in power?
On a regional level, there's now a concerted effort to marginalize all Islamists, even the mainstream ones. So, for example, if you look at Saudi Arabia or the UAE, they don't just see ISIS as the enemy. They see the Muslim Brotherhood as an enemy because they see the Brotherhood and groups like it as a threat to their religious legitimacy in the region. So I worry that if we keep on going in this direction, that we keep on excluding even the pragmatic mainstream Islamists from the political process, that that's just going to continue fueling radicalization. Islamists have to believe that they have space in the political process, that they can participate and even come to power through democratic elections. That's what people vote for. Now, we don't have to like it, but democracy isn't about liking the outcomes. Democracy is about respecting the outcomes. And that's why I think democracy is so challenging, because what do you do if someone comes to power who you really don't like? You have to find a way to work with that. I mean, the bigger issue, though, is that there are real foundational divides between Islamists and secularists in the Middle East over the nature of the nation state, over the role of religion in public life. So I'm not saying that those divides are going to be pushed to the side. They're going to be with us for the foreseeable future. That's the reality of the new Middle East. But my hope is that if people hate each other, they agree to hate each other within the democratic process, without killing each other. And this is where I think Tunisia does provide some optimism, that there is a working democratic process there, and they just had successful elections. But there's a darker undercurrent in Tunisia that's worth noting, and Islamists didn't win these elections, but I wonder if Ennahda had won, if they had been more aggressive, more conservative, and tried to satisfy their rank-and-file supporters, some of who have been complaining that Ennahda hasn't been Islamic enough. So what if Ennahda moves further to the right? Would the secular opposition be willing to accept that, or would you see a breakdown in political order? So there's almost a double standard here that a secular coalition won in Tunisia. So everyone was saying, oh, great, the secularists won. We can kind of let out a sigh of relief. But we're still not comfortable with the idea of Islamists doing well in democratic elections and even winning. So it's an open question. And let's say 4 years from now, Ennahda wins. Is the world going to be freaking out about it? And that's going to be the true test for Tunisia, that would secular parties be willing to accept Islamists in positions of power and actually reflecting their Islamism in government?
We hope to continue this conversation at another time. I'd like to thank our guest, Shadi Hamid. His book is Temptations of Power, Islamists and Illiberal Democracy in a New Middle East. Shadi Hamid, thank you so much for coming in and sharing your terrific insights.
Thanks for having me.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer was Rashad Smith. And joining me on the program was VOA Middle East editor and former Cairo bureau chief, Elizabeth Arrett. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. From Washington, D.C., the nation's capital, the Voice of America has brought you Press Conference USA. You can email your questions or comments about this edition of Press Conference USA to pcusa@voanews.com. And to keep up with all the latest news, tune to the Voice of America on radio, television, or the World Wide Web. Join us again next week when another newsmaker speaks with journalists about the critical issues facing the United States and the world. We'll see you next week for another edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.